good afternoon. It's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading, and we've been reading H.P. Lovecraft's It at the Mountains of Madness, a 1930s sort of horror story from the man who created the modern-day phenomenon of the Cthulhu franchise, board gaming and computer games and things like that. Okay, but before we go any further, word from our sponsors.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700.
And they're open 9:30 to 4:30 on weekdays. The branch will now be closed on Saturdays.
A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or sourced from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who helped to make our little radio station possible. Well, we've been looking into Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, and of course we're in a situation where I'll take us back just a little bit, and our two explorers are about to go into this alien, very alien, underworld, for want of a better term, that dates back at least 500,000 years, if not several million. And we'll go back just so as you can go from where they enter into this mysterious and frightening complex. After a time, we came across a row of windows in the bulges of a colossal five-ridged cone of undamaged apex, which led into a vast, well-preserved room with stone flooring, but these were too high in the room to permit of descent without a rope. We had a rope with us, but did not wish to bother with this 20-foot drop unless obliged to, especially in this thin plateau air where great demands were made upon the heart action. This enormous room was probably a hall or a concourse of some sort, and our electric torches showed bold, distinct, and potentially startling sculptures arranged around the walls in broad horizontal bands, separated by equally broad strips of conventional arabesques. We took careful note of this spot, planning to enter here unless a more easily gained interior were encountered. Finally, though, we did encounter exactly the opening we wished, an archway about 6 feet wide and 10 feet high, marking the former end of an aerial bridge, which had spanned an alley about 5 feet above the present level of glaciation. These archways, of course, were flush with upper story floors, and in this case one of the floors still existed. The building thus accessible was a series of rectangular terraces on our left, facing westward. That across the alley where the other archway yawned was a decrepit cylinder with no windows and with a curious bulge about 10 feet above the aperture. It was totally dark inside, and the archway seemed to open on a well of unlimitable emptiness. Heaped debris made the entrance to the vast left-hand building doubly easy. Yet for a moment we hesitated before taking advantage of the long-wished chance. For though we had penetrated into this tangle of archaic mystery, it required fresh resolution to carry us actually inside a complete and surviving building of a fabulous elder world whose nature was becoming more and more hideously plain to us. In the end, however, we made the plunge and scrambled up over the rubble into the gaping embrasure. The floor beyond was of great slate slabs and seemed to form the outlet of a long, high corridor with sculptured walls. Observing the many inner archways which led off from it and realizing the probable complexity of the nest of apartments within, we decided that we must begin our system of hare and hound trailblazing. Hitherto, our compasses, together with frequent glimpses of the vast mountain range between the towers in our rear, had been enough to prevent our losing our way, but from now on, the artificial substitute would be necessary. Accordingly, we produced our extra paper, tore it into shreds of suitable size, placed these in a bag to be carried by Danforth, and prepared to use them as economically as safety would allow. This method would probably gain us immunity from straying, since there did not appear to be any strong air currents inside the primordial masonry. If such should develop, or if our paper supply should give out, we could, of course, fall back on the more secure, though more tedious and retarding, method of rock chipping. Just how extensive a territory we had opened up, well, it was impossible to guess. Without a trial, the close and frequent connection of the differing buildings made it likely that we might cross from one to another on bridges underneath the ice, except where impeded by local collapses and geologic rifts, for very little glaciation seemed to have entered the massive constructions. Almost all the areas of transparent ice had revealed the submerged windows as tightly shuttered, as if the town had been left in that uniform state, until the glacial sheet came to crystallise the lower part for all succeeding time. Indeed, one gained a curious impression that this place had been deliberately closed and deserted in some dim, bygone aeon, rather than overwhelmed by any sudden calamity or even gradual decay. Had the coming of the ice been foreseen? And had a nameless population left en masse to seek a less doomed abode? The precise physiographic conditions attending the formation of the ice sheet at this point would have to await solution. It had not, very plainly, been a grinding drive. Perhaps the pressure of accumulated snows had been responsible, and perhaps some flood from the river or from the bursting of some ancient glacial dam in the Great Range had helped to create the special state now observable. Imagination could conceive almost anything in connection with this place. It would be cumbrous to give a detailed, consecutive account of our wanderings inside that cavernous, aeon-dead honeycomb of primal masonry, that monstrous lair of elder secrets, which now echoed for the first time after uncounted epochs to the tread of human feet. This is especially true because so much of the horrible drama and revelation came from a mere study of the omnipresent mural carvings. Our flashlight photographs of these carvings will do much toward proving the truth of what we are now disclosing, and it is lamentable that we had not a larger supply of film with us. As it was, we made crude notebook sketches of certain salient features after all our films were used up. The building which we had entered was one of great size and elaborateness, and gave us an impressive notion of the architecture of that nameless geologic past. The inner partitions were less massive than the outer walls, but on the lower levels were excellently preserved artwork. Labyrinthine complexity, involving curiously irregular differences in floor levels characterised the entire arrangement, and we should certainly have been lost at the very outset but for the trail of torn paper left behind us. We decided to explore the more decrepit upper parts first of all, hence climbed aloft in the maze for a distance of some 100 feet to where the topmost tier of chambers yawned snowily and ruinously open to the polar sky. Ascent was effected over the steep, transversely ribbed stone ramps or inclined planes, which everywhere served in lieu of stairs. The rooms we encountered were all of imaginable shapes and proportions, ranging from five-pointed stars to triangles and perfect cubes. It might be safe to say that their general average was about 30 by 30 feet in floor area and about 20 feet in height, though many larger apartments existed. After thoroughly examining the upper regions and the glacial level, we descended story by story into the submerged part, where indeed we soon saw we were in a continuous maze of connected chambers and passageways, probably leading over unlimited areas outside this particular building. The cyclopean massiveness and giganticism of everything about us became curiously oppressive, and there was something vaguely but deeply unhuman in all the contours, dimensions, proportions, decorations, and constructional nuances of the blasphemously archaic stonework. Soon we realized what the carvings revealed, that this monstrous city was many, many millions of years old. We cannot yet explain the engineering principles used in the anomalous balancing and adjustment of the vast rock masses, though the function of the arch was clearly much relied on. The rooms we visited were wholly bare of all portable contents, a circumstance which sustained our belief in the city's deliberate desertion. The prime decorative feature was the almost universal system of mural sculpture, which tended to run in continuous horizontal bands, 3 feet wide and arranged from floor to ceiling in alternation with bands of equal width given over to geometrical arabesques. There were exceptions to this rule of arrangement, but its preponderance was overwhelming. Often, however, a series of smooth cartouches containing oddly patterned groups of dots would be sunk along one of the arabesque bands. The technique, we soon saw, was mature, accomplished, and aesthetically evolved to the highest degree of civilized mastery, though utterly alien in every detail to any known art tradition of the human race. In delicacy of execution, no sculpture I have ever seen could approach it. The minutest details of elaborate vegetation or of animal life were rendered with astonishing vividness, despite the bold scale of the carvings, whilst the conventional designs were marvels of skillful intricacy. The arabesques displayed a profound use of mathematical principles and were made up of obscurely symmetrical curves and angles based on the quantity of five. The pictorial bands followed a highly formalized tradition and involved a peculiar treatment of perspective, but had an artistic force that moved us profoundly, notwithstanding the intervening gulf of vast geologic periods. Their method of design hinged on a singular juxtaposition of the cross-section with two-dimensional silhouette and embodied an analytical psychology beyond that of any known race of antiquity. It is useless to try to compare this art with any represented in our museums. Those who see our photographs will probably find its closest analogue in certain grotesque conceptions of the most daring futurists. The arabesque tracery consisted altogether of depressed lines, whose depth on unweathered walls varied from 1 to 2 inches. When cartouches with dot groups appeared, evidently as inscriptions in some unknown and primordial language and alphabet, the depression of the smooth surface was perhaps 1.5 inches, and of the dots perhaps 1/2 inch more. The pictorial bands were in countersunk low relief, their background being depressed about 2 inches from the original wall surface. In some specimens, marks of a former coloration could be detected, though for the most part, the untold aeons had disintegrated and banished any pigments which may have been applied. The more one studied the marvellous technique, the more one admired the things. Beneath their strict conventionalization, one could grasp the minute and accurate observation and graphic skill of the artists, and indeed, the very conventions themselves serve to symbolise and accentuate the real essence or vital differentiation of every object delineated. We felt too that besides these recognisable excellences, there were others lurking beyond the reach of our perceptions. Certain touches here and there gave vague hints of latent symbols and stimuli, which another mental and emotional background and a fuller or different sensory equipment might have made of profound and poignant significance to us. The subject matter of the sculptures obviously came from the life of the vanished epoch of their creation and contained a large proportion of evident history. It is this abnormal historic mindedness of the primal race, a chance circumstance operating through coincidence, miraculously in our favour, which made the carvings so awesomely informative to us, and which caused us to place their photography and transcription above all other considerations. In certain rooms, the dominant arrangement was varied by the presence of maps, astronomical charts, and other scientific designs on an enlarged scale, these things giving a naive and terrible corroboration to what we gathered from the pictorial friezes and dados. In hinting at what the whole revealed, I can only hope that my account will not arouse a curiosity greater than sane caution on the part of those who believe me at all. It would be tragic if any were to be allured to that realm of death and horror by the very warning meant to discourage them. Interrupting these sculptured walls were high windows and massive 12-foot doorways, both now and then retaining the petrified wooden planks, elaborately carved and polished. Of the actual shutters and doors, all metal fixtures had long ago vanished, but some of the doors remained in place and had to be forced aside as we progressed from room to room. Window frames with odd transparent panes, mostly elliptical, survived here and there, though in no considerable quantity. There were also frequent niches of great magnitude, generally empty, but once in a while containing some bizarre object carved from green soapstone, which was either broken or perhaps held too inferior to warrant removal. Other apertures were undoubtedly connected with bygone mechanical facilities, heating, lighting and the like, of a sort suggested in many of the carvings. Ceilings tended to be plain, but had sometimes been inlaid with green soapstone or other tiles, mostly fallen now. Floors were also paved with such tiles, though plain stonework predominated. As I have said, all furniture and other movables were absent, but the sculptures gave a clear idea of the strange devices which had once filled these tomb-like echoing rooms. Above the glacial sheet, the floors were generally thick with detritus, litter and debris, but farther down this condition decreased. In some of the lower chambers and corridors there was little more than gritty dust or ancient incrustations, while occasional areas had an uncanny air of newly swept immaculateness. Of course, where rifts or collapses had occurred, the lower levels were as littered as the upper ones. A central court, as in other structures we had seen from the air, saved the inner regions from total darkness, so that we seldom had to use our electric torches in the upper rooms, except when studying sculptured details. Below the ice cap, however, the twilight deepened, and in many parts of the tangled ground level, there was an approach to absolute darkness. To form even a rudimentary idea of our thoughts and feelings, as we penetrated this eon-silent maze of unhuman masonry, one must correlate a hopelessly bewildering chaos of fugitive moods, memories and impressions. The sheer appalling antiquity and the lethal desolation of the place were enough to overwhelm almost any sensitive person. But added to these elements were the recent unexplained horror at the camp, and the revelations all too soon affected by the terrible mural sculptures around us. The moment we came upon a perfect section of carving where no ambiguity of interpretation could exist, it took only a brief study to give us the hideous truth. A truth which it would be naive to claim Danforth and I had not independently suspected before, though we had carefully refrained from even hinting it to each other. There could now be no further merciful doubts about the nature of the beings which had built and inhabited this monstrous dead city millions of years ago. when man's ancestors were primitive, archaic mammals and vast dinosaurs roamed the tropical steppes of Europe and Asia. We had previously clung to a desperate alternative and insisted each to himself that the omnipresence of the five-pointed motif meant only some cultural or religious exaltation of the Archean natural object which had so patiently embodied the quality of five-pointedness as the decorative motifs of Minoan Crete exalted the sacred bull, those of Egypt, the Sacrobaeus, those of Rome the wolf and the eagle, and those of various savage tribes some chosen totem animal. But this lone refuge was now stripped from us. We were forced to face definitely the reason-shaking realization which the reader of these pages has doubtless long ago anticipated. I can scarcely bear to write it down in black and white, even now, but perhaps that will not be necessary. The things once rearing and dwelling in this frightful masonry in the age of dinosaurs were not, indeed, dinosaurs, but far worse. Mere dinosaurs were new and almost brainless objects, but the builders of the city, they were wise and old, and had left certain traces in rocks even then, laid down well nigh 1,000,000,000 years. Rocks laid down before the true life of Earth had advanced beyond plastic groups of cells. Rocks laid down before the true life of Earth had existed at all. They were the makers and enslavers of that life, and above all doubts the originals of the fiendish elder myths, which things like the Narcotic Manuscripts and the Necronomicon affrightedly hint about. They were the great old ones that had filtered down from the stars when the Earth was young, the beings whose substance and alien evolution had shaped and whose powers were such as this planet had never bred. And to think that only the day before, Danforth and I had actually looked upon the fragments of their millennially fossiled substance, and that poor Lake and his party had seen their complete outlines. It is, of course, impossible for me to relate in proper order the stages by which we picked up what we know of that monstrous chapter of pre-human life. After the first shock of the certain revelation, we had to pause a while to recuperate, and it was fully 3 o'clock before we got started on our actual tour of systematic research. The sculptures in the building we entered were of relatively late date, perhaps 2,000,000 years ago, as checked by geological, biological, and astronomical features, and embodied an art which would be called decadent in comparison with that of specimens we found in older buildings after crossing bridges under the glacial sheet. One edifice, hewn from the solid rock, seemed to go back 40 or possibly even 50 million years to the lower Eocene or upper Cretaceous and contained bas-reliefs of an artistry surpassing anything else, with one tremendous exception that we encountered. That was, we have since agreed, the oldest domestic structure we traversed. Were it not for the support of those flashlights soon to be made public, I would refrain from telling what I found and inferred, lest I be confined as a madman. Of course, the infinitely early parts of the patchwork tale, representing the pre-terrestrial life of the star-headed beings on other planets and in other galaxies and indeed in other universes, can readily be interpreted as the fantastic mythology of those beings themselves. Yet, such parts sometimes involve designs and diagrams so uncannily close to the latest findings of mathematics and astrophysics that I scarcely know what to think. Let others judge when they see the photographs I shall publish. Naturally, no one set of carvings which we encountered told more than a fraction of any connected story, nor did we even begin to come upon the various stages of that story in their proper order. Some of the vast rooms were independent units so far as their designs were concerned, whilst in other cases a continuous chronicle would be carried through a series of rooms and corridors. The best of the maps and diagrams were on the walls of a frightful abyss, below even the ancient ground level, a cavern perhaps 200 feet square and 60 feet wide, which had almost undoubtedly been an educational centre of some sort. There were many provoking repetitions of the same material in different rooms and buildings since certain chapters of experience and certain summaries or phases of racial history had evidently been favourites with different decorators or dwellers. Sometimes, though, variant versions of the same theme proved useful in setting debatable points and filling in gaps. I still wonder that we deduced so much in the short time at our disposal. Of course, we only have the barest outline, and much of that was obtained later on from a study of the photographs and sketches we made. It may be the effect of this later study, the revived memories and vague impressions acting in conjunction with his general sensitiveness and with that final supposed horror glimpse of whose essence he will not reveal even to me, which has been the immediate source of Danforth's present breakdown. But it had to be, for we could not issue our warning intelligently without the fullest possible information, and the issuance of that warning is a prime necessity. Certain lingering influences in that unknown Antarctic world of disordered time and alien natural law make it imperative that further exploration be discouraged. The full story, so far as deciphered, will shortly appear in an official bulletin of the Miskatonic University. Here I shall sketch only the salient highlights in a formless, rambling way. Myth or otherwise, the sculptures told of the coming of those star-headed things to the nascent, lifeless Earth, out of cosmic space. Their coming and the coming of many other alien entities, such as at certain times embark upon spatial pioneering. They seemed able to traverse the interstellar ether on their vast membranous wings, thus oddly confirming some curious hill folklore long ago told me by an antiquarian colleague. They had lived under the sea a good deal, building fantastic cities and fighting terrific battles with nameless adversaries by means of intricate devices employing unknown principles of energy. Evidently, their scientific and mechanical knowledge far surpassed man's today, though they made use of its more widespread and elaborate forms only when obliged to. Some of the sculptures suggest that they had passed through a stage of mechanized life on other planets, but had receded upon finding its effects emotionally unsatisfying. Their preternatural toughness of organization and simplicity of natural wants made them peculiarly able to live on a high plane without the more specialized fruits of artificial manufacture. And even without garments except for occasional protection against the elements. It was under the sea, at first for food and later for other purposes, that they first created Earth life, using available substances according to long-known methods. The more elaborate experiments came after the annihilation of various cosmic enemies. They had done the same thing on other planets, having manufactured not only necessary foods, but certain multicellular protoplasmic masses capable of moulding their tissues into all sorts of temporary organs under hypnotic influence and thereby forming ideal slaves to perform the heavy work of the community. These viscous masses were without doubt what Abdul Al-Hazared whispered as Shoggoths. In his frightful Necronomicon, though even that mad Arab had not hinted that any existed on Earth except in the dreams of those who had chewed a certain alkaloidal herb. When the star-headed old ones on this planet had synthesized their simple food forms and bred a good supply of shoggoths, they allowed other cell groups to develop in other forms of animal and vegetable life, for sundry purposes, extirpating any whose presence became troublesome. With the aid of the Shoggoths, whose expansion could be made to lift prodigious weights, the small low cities under the sea grew to vast and imposing labyrinths of stone, not unlike those which later rose on land. Indeed, the highly adaptable old ones had lived much on land in other parts of the universe, and probably retained many traditions of land construction. As we studied the architecture of all these sculptural Pelagian cities, including that whose eon-dreaded corridors we were even then traversing, we were impressed by a curious coincidence, which we have not yet tried to explain even to ourselves. The tops of the buildings, which in the actual city around us had of course been weathered into shapeless ruins ages ago, were clearly displayed in the base reliefs and showed vast clusters of needle-like spires, delicate finials of certain cone and pyramidal apexes, and tiers of thin horizontal scalloped discs capping cylindrical shafts. This was exactly what we had seen in that monstrous and portentous mirage cast by the dead city, when such skyline features had been absent for thousands and indeed tens of thousands of years, which loomed on our ignorant eyes across the unfathomed mountains of madness as we first approached Poor Lake's ill-fated camp. Of the life of the old ones, both under the sea and, after part of them, migrated to land, volumes could be written. Those in shallow water continued the fullest use of the eyes at the ends of their five main head tentacles, and had practised the arts of sculpture and of writing in quite the usual way, the writing accomplished with a stylus on waterproof waxen surfaces. Those lower down in the ocean depths, though they used a curious phosphorescent organism to furnish light, they used a with obscure special lenses and sensors operating through the prismatic cilia of their heads. Sensors. Which rendered. My apologies. Sensors which rendered all the old ones partly independent of light in emergencies. Their forms of sculpture and writing had changed curiously during the descent, embodying certain apparently chemical coating processes, probably to secure phosphorescence, which the bas-reliefs could not make clear to us. The beings moved in the sea partly by swimming, using the lateral crinoidal arms, and partly by wriggling with the lower tier of tentacles containing the pseudo feet. Occasionally, they accomplished long swoops with the auxiliary use of two or more sets of their fan-like folding wings. On land, they locally used the pseudo feet, but now and then flew to great heights or over long distances with their wings. The many slender tentacles into which the crinoid arms branched were infinitely delicate, flexible, strong, and accurate in muscular nervous coordination, ensuring the utmost skill and dexterity in all artistic and other manual operations. The toughness of the things was almost incredible. Even the terrific pressures of the deepest sea bottoms appeared powerless to harm them. Very few seemed to die at all, except by violence, and their burial places were very limited. The fact that they covered their vertically inhumed head with five-pointed inscribed mounds set up thoughts in Danforth and me, which made a fresh pause and recuperation necessary after the sculptures revealed it. The beings multiplied by means of spores, like vegetables to pterophytes, as Lake had suspected, but owing to their prodigious toughness and longevity, and consequent lack of replacement needs, they did not encourage the large-scale development of new protale except when they had new regions to colonise. The young matured swiftly and received an education evidently beyond any standard we can imagine. The prevailing intellectual and aesthetic life was highly evolved and produced a tenaciously enduring set of customs and institutions which I shall describe more fully in my coming monograph. These varied slightly according to sea or land residents, but had the same foundations and essentials. Though able, like vegetables, to derive nourishment from inorganic substances, they vastly preferred organic and especially animal food. They ate uncooked marine life under the sea, but cooked their viands on land. They hunted game and raised meat herds, slaughtering with sharp weapons, but whose odd marks on certain fossil bones our expedition had noted. They resisted all ordinary temperatures marvellously, and in their natural state could live in water down to freezing. When the great chill of the Pleistocene grew on, however, nearly 100 million years ago, the land dwellers had to resort to special measures, including artificial heating, until at last the deadly cold appears to have driven them back into the sea. For their prehistoric flights through cosmic space, legend said, they absorbed certain chemicals and became almost independent of eating, breathing, or heat conditions. But by the time of the great cold, they had lost track of the method. In any case, they could not have prolonged the artificial state indefinitely without harm. Being non-pairing and semi-vegetable in structure, the old ones had no biological mass for the family phase of mammal life, but seemed to organise large households on the principles of comfortable space utility and, as we deduced from the picture, pictured occupations and diversions of co-dwellers, congenial mental association. In furnishing their homes, they kept everything in the centre of the huge rooms, leaving all the wall spaces free for decorative treatment. Lighting, in the case of the land inhabitants, was accomplished by a device probably electrochemical in nature. Both on the land and underwater, they used curious tables, chairs and couches, like cylindrical frames, for they rested and slept upright with folded down tentacles, and racks for the hinge sets of dotted surfaces forming their books. Government was evidently complex, probably socialistic, though no certainties in this guard could be deduced from the sculptures that we saw. There was extensive commerce, both local and between different cities, certain small flat counters, five-pointed and inscribed, serving as money. Probably the smaller of the various greenish soapstones found by expedition were pieces of such currency. Though the culture was mainly urban, some agriculture and much stock-raising existed. Mining and a limited amount of manufacturing were also practiced. Travel was very frequent, but permanent migration seemed relatively rare, except for the last vast colonising movements by which the race expanded. For personal locomotion, no external aid was used, since in land, air and water movement alike, the old ones seemed to possess excessively vast capacities for speed. Loads, however, were drawn by beasts of burden, shoggoths under the sea, and a curious variety of primitive vertebrates in the later years of land existence. These vertebrates, as well as an infinity of other life forms, animal and vegetable, marine, terrestrial and aerial, were the products of unguided evolution, acting on life cells made by the old ones, but escaping beyond their radius of attention. They had been suffered to develop unchecked because they had not come in conflict with the dominant beings. Bothersome forms, of course, were mechanically exterminated. It interested us to see in some of the very last and most decadent sculptures a shambling primitive mammal, used sometimes for food and sometimes as an amusing buffoon by the land dwellers whose vaguely simian and human foreshadowings were unmistakable. In the building of land cities, the huge blocks of the high towers were generally lifted by vast-winged pterodactyls of a species heretofore unknown to paleontology. Well, that's our book reading for this week. My apologies, I for some reason had a tickle in my throat, so a few pauses there. Sorry to break it up that way. But nonetheless, I hope you're finding Mountains of Madness interesting. Fascinating that this guy had come up with the idea of terraforming. I hadn't realised that until today, actually, but he gives a pretty clear description of how the old ones were able to reform the planet to suit themselves in a way that they could adapt and survive and indeed grow as a civilization. He really was a rather amazing man for his time. Anyway, until next week, take care, Braidwood, and I think we're all growing fins at the moment. Let's just see what happens. For now, keep safe.